here. So I'm very happy to be here. This is fifth in a series, for those of you who have been here, on the hindrances to practice. So I am batting cleanup. We're on number five tonight. So I thought maybe what we would do is first talk very briefly about the hindrances as a group. And I want to give you, I'm going to tell you a little story. So I live in Inverness, which is up by Point Reyes Station over in West Marin. So when I leave here tonight, I have an intention of going home and making it all the way there. And I know how I'm going to do that. I'm going to go up to 280, and I'm going to take 280 north, and I'm going to take 19th through San Francisco, and I'm going to cross the Golden Gate Bridge, and I'm going to go 101 up to Lucas Valley Road, and then I'm going to take Lucas Valley Road out to the coast, and eventually I'm going to get onto my dirt road, and then I'm going to get to the end of that dirt road, and then I'll be home. So I know how I'm going to do that. And it's going to take me about, an hour and a half. You know, I know about how long it's going to take. And I have a lot of incentive to go home. I'm ready to go. But when I leave here, I might decide I'm driving along. I'm doing just fine. And I know, look, Stonestown is open. You know, I could go in there. I've wanted to check out. It looks like Nordstrom is still open. I don't know if Nordstrom is there, but there's a store here. I'm going to go off and just check this out and maybe see what, you know, there's something I've been meaning to look at, and this is just my opportunity. I deserve this after all. I work hard. I'm going to go. And pretty soon I've totally forgotten that my goal is to get home. It's an hour and a half. I have a long drive. I've forgotten that. I've been subsumed by desire. Okay, suppose I make it past that and I'm driving along. Oh, that guy just cut me off. I can't believe he cut me off. I'm pretty much, here I am in the throes of ill will. I am totally steamed at this guy cutting me off. I'm going to show him what that's like, and I'm going to go over here and show him just what it's like to be cut off, and I'm getting all wrapped up in the anger over this thing, and I can no longer remember that all I want to do is drive home, and I'm getting all steamed up to the point where I've forgotten this is easy. I just need to go, right? Okay, so I get past desire and ill will. And I'm driving along, and I'm really tired. Oh, I am so tired. And pretty soon, people start honking because I'm just not quite going fast enough. I'm down to 40 miles an hour. I may never get home. But I am so tired. I just don't think I can make it. I don't know why I thought I could do this, but maybe I'll just try to keep my eyes open a little longer. Deep in the throes of sloth and torpor, I'm never going to get there. But suppose I get out of that and I'm going along and I'm ready. I've had some coffee now. I'm going to go. Here I am. I'm going. Oh, I wish I was home. I'm so uncomfortable. Maybe if I just adjust my seat a little bit, I'll adjust my seat. Well, you know, maybe I need to stop and get another coffee. That might make it better. I'll just stop and get a little coffee. How long is this going to take? And now I'm deep in the throes of restlessness. And once again, I've totally forgotten that all I need to do is just drive home. I'm getting all wrapped up in something that's totally distracting me from what I really need to do, which is to drive home. Okay, but I get past restlessness, and the next thing you know, I'm thinking, I don't think I can do this. I just can't do this. There's got to be a better way. Maybe if I just stop, I could give Carol a call, see if I could stay at Carol's house tonight. I just don't know. Or maybe, you know, it might be easier if I took maybe instead of going 280, I should just take 101 the whole way. Maybe the traffic won't be so bad. I'm just not sure. What if I go, maybe I should wait till tomorrow morning and drive home. all of this wavering and indecisiveness, this doubt about my ability to get home, is keeping me from getting home. And that's what our goal is. We think of our intentions, and we're set out on the road to these intentions, and then we get distracted by these hindrances. These hindrances that keep us from going where we intend to go, where we really know that we can go. They keep us from getting home. So what we've been talking about, what has been talked about the last few weeks, are all of these hindrances, and the one we get to talk about tonight is doubt. Doubt. You know, one of the interesting things that happened as I started preparing for this is I was trying to think of things that would make it real. So I was thinking about times when I've been overcome by doubt. And I kept getting more and more depressed. And I realized I was once again becoming overwhelmed by doubt. Oh, maybe I can't do this. Maybe, oh, you know, and I thought, I spent hours looking for appropriate poems. You know, people don't write poems on doubt because they're so doubtful they can't get through them. They just can't get through them. It doesn't happen. Doubt is the thing that is really most dangerous about the hindrances, because doubt is the thing that will make you stop practicing. Doubt is what drags you down to the point where you just say, oh, no, I can't do this. I won't do this. So it's very important to understand doubt and to know what to do about it when you encounter it, and to rejoice when you pass through it. So that's what we're going to talk about. So all of these hindrances disconnect us from our practice. They disconnect us from seeing clearly. They take us out of our intentions and get us off into some place where we can't move ahead, where we can't be where we want to be. What happens is we allow moods and perceptions to take over. You know, instead of just going on mindfully with our practice, we become overwhelmed by things that are passing through. They're really passing through. They're not going to stay, but they can seem like something that is with us forever. Doubt is certainly like that. And it's very seductive, because actually it sometimes seems very smart. When we start getting wrapped up in our minds, in the story that whatever the hindrance is telling us, it's very difficult to get out of it. We're sort of tied up, and all of our energy is following the story of what those hindrances are telling us. So the first thing we have to do is recognize the hindrance when it shows up. And they can be very subtle. Doubt is particularly subtle. The first thing that usually happens when we think about doubt is self-doubt. You know, the first thing we do is say, oh, it's me, I can't do this. Right? We become very good at that. There's a certain amount of doubt that is quite healthy. That's the doubt that comes from looking at something you see and trying to be sure you're not just getting caught up in a belief about something, and that something that removes you from the present moment and gets you once again into some story. So there was, I'm going to tell you a story about Mara and his attendants. Mara is the embodiment of evil in Buddhist stories. He's the tempter, and he's referred to in the suttas as the evil one, Mara. So Mara and his attendants were strolling along, and they see this monk that's walking, and he's doing walking meditation. And suddenly he lights up, and he sees he has a big smile on his face. And so one of the attendants says to Mara, oh my God, what happened? Why is he so happy? And Mara said, oh, he just saw a piece of truth. And the attendant says, oh my God, what are we going to do? This is terrible. We should do something about this. And he said, oh, don't worry, don't worry. Next thing you know, it's going to be a belief. The first thing we do when we find a piece of truth is we turn it into something we have to believe in. And then it loses its energy. It loses its aliveness. It loses its in-the-momentness. It becomes something that we put up on a shelf as a belief, and we cling to that belief, and we hold on to it very tightly. And the ability to look at what we believe and question it can be considered skillful doubt. It's the skill that keeps us engaged in what is real, what's truly happening in front of us. So that kind of doubt, that's a good doubt. That's a skillful doubt. The doubt that is known as the hindrance derives from the Pali word, which is vikicca. Vikiticca. And it refers to this wavering, hesitation, this uncertainty, that kind of doubt. It's a doubt that is kind of reactive. So it sees something and it goes, oh, I don't think so. Okay? Now, I'm not talking about cynical doubt, which is, you know, prove it to me, I don't believe anything. You know, that's over here on this extreme. But it's the doubt that just loses trust in what's happening. So a friend of mine gave me this image for doubt. She said, I'll tell you what the image for me is. There's this large board, and I'm walking on this board, and I'm doing my mindfulness practice, and I'm doing all of the things that I think should be good. I'm exercising compassion. I'm doing all of the pieces of the path that I think will get me there. But I secretly know that underneath this board is a monster. And that this board is, in fact, living in the jaws of that monster. And that at any moment, he can clap those jaws shut. And I said, my God, that's really scary. And she said, yeah, that's what my doubt is like. It's very scary. And that's an important thing to understand. When you recognize doubt, to look at what is it that is leading up to that doubt. For her, it's fear. It's fear of a lot of things. But for you, it may be something different. For you, it may be dissatisfaction. It may be disappointment. But doubt is that thing that says, I'm not good at this. I'm never going to be good at this. I can't sit that long. My knee hurts. I'll never be able. My knees are so bad. I'm not going to be able to do that. What kind of a crazy practice is that that requires me to keep my knees in such bad shape? You know, that's where doubt is, right? I can't sit still that long. I just don't have enough discipline. I'll probably just always be bad at this. Why should I do something that makes me feel so bad all the time? This is doubt. And very often, self-doubt especially, is based on comparing mind. Look at her. She is sitting like a mountain. Oh, I'll never be able to sit like that. Oh, my God. I sat next to somebody for a month on a month-long retreat in March, and I'll tell you, this woman sat like a mountain. She was amazing. She never moved. I'll never be like that. But rather than saying, that makes me a bad meditator, I simply say, I'll never be like that. And who knows, maybe someday I will be. Not in the short term, however. So beware of comparing mind. It often leads to doubt about yourself when it doesn't have anything to do with what's truly real. She could have been having a terrible meditation. She just sat still. Actually, I don't think there's any such thing as a bad meditation, so I'll retract that. Okay, so that's one thing. is to beware of comparing mind. That often leads to doubt and leaves us in a place where we can't quite see our way out, where we don't feel that we can do the practice. Sometimes we even judge ourselves for being in doubt. Oh, doubt again. We do this with all of the hindrance, by the way. I do this too. I used to get very upset when I would first start sitting. I would be very restless. I had a lot of trouble with restlessness. I have the world's largest collection of meditation cushions. This is the way I solved that problem. Okay, so self-doubt is something that we're so familiar with, we can probably locate it pretty quickly. We notice it. But what about the doubt that we don't notice? When we start questioning things and we don't recognize it as doubt, that's when it really becomes an obscuration for us. When we get to the place where you say, you know, I've been practicing a long time and I just don't seem to ever get calm. Or, you know, I haven't had an insight in 2 years. I'm just too tired. Maybe I just can't do this practice now. Maybe next year would be a better time to do this practice. Every time you hear yourself starting to make these kinds of arguments, look for doubt. And the reason for looking for it is that once you name it, it has less power over you. When you realize, oh, this is doubt. Oh, doubt. Oh, yeah, I recognize you. It takes some of the power out of that. It gives you a way of dealing with it. You can recognize it and you can say, ah, doubt, I know this friend. The other thing that happens as we're going along is we'll say, you know, this teaching doesn't make sense. Who could believe that? There must be something wrong here. You know, I just can't buy into this. Maybe this just isn't the right practice for me. There's got to be something else. That actually happened to me for a very long time. It took me a long time before I ever sat on the cushion. I read a lot of Buddhist books, and I said, you know, this whole idea of no self, just, I can't buy it. And so what I did, even though a lot of things appealed to me, I said, not for me. That makes no sense. I can't deal with it. We have this tendency of throwing everything out when there's something that we can't accept, that just doesn't feel right to us. That's a good time to pay a lot of attention to what it is that's bothering you. You know, what is it that's coming up? What's the story? The other thing that happens is you might decide it's this teacher. I can't stand that teacher. Why is she smiling all the time? Life is not a bowl of cherries. What's with the smile thing? You know? And pretty soon you're off telling stories about how bad this teacher is. And it may be that you can't stand the teacher for some reason. It may be that the teacher has said something that contradicts something you believe. It may be that the teacher is a bad teacher. But all of these things are things that really don't need to affect your practice. Because the practice is staying in the present moment and being aware of what's happening in the present moment. So when you find yourself saying, this isn't the right place, maybe I should take up Sufi dancing, or, you know, those Tibetans are pretty cool. They've got lots of nice rituals in the Dalai Lama. My God, he's so wonderful. Maybe I should go try the Tibetan practice for a while. Or today I was at hospice this afternoon. And one of the things that we do is we check in. All the volunteers check in at every shift. And last weekend there was a retreat for the volunteers for Zen Hospice Project. And one of the people was reporting his impressions of that retreat. And he said, well, you know, Ajahn Amaro, who is one of the venerable teachers in our tradition and is the abbot of a forest monastery in Northern California, was the teacher for this retreat. And this person said, I don't understand why the Zen Hospice Project would have a Theravadan teacher and not a Zen teacher for the retreat. And so someone said, well, if you've ever heard Ajahn Amaro, he's an absolutely inspiring teacher. He's quite wonderful. And somebody said, well, what did you object to? And he said, oh, I didn't listen to him. He says, I was meditating. Okay. Well, now that we've got that straight, we know we don't have to listen to a teacher if he doesn't have the right label on it, right? This is doubt. This is subtle doubt. This is doubt that you don't recognize as doubt. So every time you start hearing the arguments, this is what happens with me. When I start hearing a lot of repeating arguments, I know that's where I am. So the problem with doubt is it weakens us just at the time when we really need our strength the most. And we become disheartened. We lose heart. So what we need to do is figure out how to resolve doubt when it arises. What do we do about doubt? There are several possibilities, and not the same thing will work for every person and every opportunity, but there are things that we can do about doubt. The first thing to do is to distinguish between healthy or skillful doubt and doubt that is reactive, that is a result of causes and conditions that we're involved in. So then it becomes the task of looking at what is the story behind my doubt. What am I telling myself about this doubt? So there's a certain amount of investigation that happens. Another thing that will help us recognize doubt when it comes up is to pay attention to what's happened just before. If you find yourself doubting, ask yourself, what just happened right before this? Sometimes it's something good might have happened. For example, you might have just reached some amazing insight. You're sitting there and something's been bothering you and you're watching your breath, watching your breath, watching your breath. And all of a sudden, you feel total ecstasy. Wow, where did that come from? Wow, where did it go? Why don't I still have it? What did I do wrong? Oh, I did something wrong. What did I do? That was so great. And pretty soon you're condemning yourself for something. For what? Something wonderful entered your life and passed through. And the same thing is true. Sometimes it's a bad thing that happens and you lose yourself in that. So it's important to treat doubt as a messenger. It's a teacher for you. It tells you something. But it's not something that you can reason your way through. You can't reason your way out of doubt. I've tried. You can't talk yourself out of it. You can't say, okay, if I just think about it, I'll figure out why this happened. So the object is not to figure out why it happened, only to notice that it's there, notice that it happened. Pay attention to its presence. Recognize it as doubt. And say, oh, doubt. Mm-hmm. Doubt. There was a time, the first retreat I ever went on was taught by two wonderful women teachers, one of whom I decided was really terrible. And as I sat there, we were doing a guided meditation. And I said, I can't stand this. I don't belong here. Why did I do this? And I took off. I left. And I went out into the woods, and I wandered back and forth. And it wasn't exactly a walking meditation. I was storming. I was... And I'd pick up branches and throw them because I was so frustrated that I could not be the open-hearted person that I wanted to be. That's what was really happening. But I want you to know it was the teacher's fault. It was definitely the teacher's fault. She was so bad. As I was racing back and forth in the woods, trying to find my way out of this doubt, not recognizing it as doubt, just condemning myself, condemning the teacher, suddenly I broke down into tears. I worked myself up into such a state that finally I broke into tears, and I realized that what I was really reacting toward was my desire to be open-hearted and the fact that I didn't feel that way when I was listening to this guided meditation. And I went back and I finished the retreat, which was a really lovely thing for me. And I still don't like guided meditation. So what I learned about myself was that what I was condemning in myself and in this teacher was in fact not what was true. What was true is that I have trouble with guided meditations. Now, and someday I'll work that through, and sometimes I can do it and sometimes I can't. But the skillful way of me dealing with the doubt was not to doubt the practice, not to doubt myself, but to realize that there was this thing happening that I was reacting to. And that got me through it. So that's the kind of investigation we want to do, is to look for what is the tension around the doubt, identify it, be sure we're looking at the right thing. So we want to find a wise way of working with the stress that has caused the doubt. So that's what we're looking for. We're not looking for a story around it. We're not trying to create a story that leads us out of the present moment. We're trying to pay strict attention to what's really true in the present moment and not the story that we tell ourselves about it. So that's the trick. Another way to resolve doubt is to talk to a teacher or talk to other practitioners who probably have experienced this also. And very often it helps you work through whatever it is that's stopping you from going ahead with your practice, that's keeping you from being able to stay with the moment and be in the moment. The truth is, the best way to resolve doubt or any of the hindrances is to stick with the practice, is to just say, I'm here to do this. I'm now on this cushion. I'm now in this chair. And my intention is to follow my breath. And for this short period of time, for this 15 minutes, for this 10 minutes, that's what I'm going to do. Even if this is all nonsense, 10 minutes. Very often, just continuing the practice will get you through it. This is different than pushing it away. We're not pushing it away. We're not denying it. We're not being aversive toward it. We're simply saying, okay, this is doubt, and I'm going to sit with doubt, and I'm going to understand doubt. I'm going to know how it feels in my body. Different kinds of doubt will have different feelings for you. When I'm full of self-doubt, what often happens is my shoulders hunch. I feel tightness in my shoulders. Sometimes you'll feel it as a butterfly feeling in your stomach, or maybe an emptiness in your chest. Figure out what it is. Know what the feeling in your body is when you're going through one of these mind states. It will help you in the future to identify what's happening and not be lost. You spend less time in that what's happening place. So then you make doubt the object of your mindfulness. And when you do that, one thing to remember is that faith can be a verb. Faith is that thing that is an active willingness to suspend judgment long enough to just move ahead. Just that long. It isn't lying to yourself. It's just saying, okay, I'm just going to live with that dichotomy for a few moments and continue watching my breath. So we practice with a kind of act of goodwill. What happens if I just try? And that, by the way, is the way I got over my problem with not self. One day I just decided that I had nothing to lose and I'd just go ahead and try sitting on the cushion and see what happens. It was kind of on a dare. I read something by Ken Wilber who said, you know, you can't judge meditation until you do it because you don't know what you're talking about. Well, okay. So I did it. And I only wish I had started sooner. And I did it with the full knowledge that there was this big thing that I didn't agree with, but I was just going to let it go. And that was a really skillful thing for me to do in that situation. Another doubt that often comes up is more a concern about your spiritual practice progress. You know, have I made any progress here? Have I gotten far enough along? I should be having these kinds of experiences by now. This is a real trap. Why am I not seeing these insights, and why am I not feeling this universal bliss and all of these things that we imagine happen to longtime practitioners all the time? In fact, some of these things do happen, but it's not the purpose of practice. The purpose of practice is to be in the present moment. So don't be lured into doubt by thinking I haven't reached some nirvana, some place of enlightenment. It's very important to realize the real beauty that comes out of a single moment of being awake. The Buddha said 100 years of practice is not worth as much as one moment of being awake. One moment. I did find a poem that has not to do so much with doubt, but I think is very fitting here. This is by Marjorie Stelmach. And she says, I've set myself the doorway task. That's the name of the poem. I've set myself the doorway task. As you pass through a doorway, remember yourself. I miss 3 a day on my way to breakfast. No concentration. But if I keep at it, I tell myself, and garner each doorway, I will have collected no less than my life. I keep at it. I learn I'm no good at this. Men are collectors. They go all out. Comic books, train models, postage stamps, guns, cigar store Indians, World War I planes. What I collect, ones. One pewter napkin ring, one old city map, one translucent face from one world's fair, one kaleidoscope, one friend, one mask. No true collector. I accumulate. Accumulator, dark body in deep space, storing up power? Yes. And the doorway task? The work continues. One day I'll come to myself in one doorway. Me, I'll say, whole, in this doorway. This moment, and know what I'm doing this for and be done with it. Me, I'll say, whole, in this doorway, this moment, and know what I'm doing this for and be done with it. So practice with that in mind, that one moment of being awake is worth doing the practice. That sparkle of being awake. I have one more thing I want to talk about, which is another way of dealing with the hindrances is to look at their antidotes. So the antidote for doubt is faith. There are many kinds of faith. Sharon Salzberg wrote a wonderful book on faith titled Faith, Our Deepest, Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience. And she makes a distinction between several kinds of faith. So there is the faith that is blind faith. I believe it. I know it. It's true. I'm done with it. That's a kind of clinging. That's a clinging kind of faith. But there's another kind that is more investigative, discovery, and it has a brightness to it. She calls it bright faith. And she says, faith is the animation of the heart that says, I choose life. I align myself with the potential inherent in life. I give myself over to that potential. This spark of faith is ignited the moment we think, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try it. There's energy in that kind of faith. It says, I'm just going to try it. It's not, I'm going to do this no matter what. It's not that energy. It's the energy that says, I'm just going to try it. There's a lightness and a brightness. This is the bright faith. And as you go along and you practice, what inevitably happens is you begin to see things and you say, oh, that's what happens. Oh, that. Oh, I understand. And you move into the realm of verifiable faith. Now you believe things based on your own direct experience. And as you continue in the practice, you become more and more comfortable with what you're doing. And it begins to have real meaning for you. It aligns up with your deepest intentions. This is called abiding faith. And it's that faith that keeps you going when you become discouraged. Because once you know something, you can't unknow it. It's always there for you. So even when you say, oh, I just don't think I can do it today, you know the positive results of following the practice, and it becomes a part of you that then sustains you for the future. I think I'm going to skip that. So this brings us back to the beginning. The hindrances are the impediments to our practice, but they're also a means of honing our practice. They can be our best teachers. They are the ways that we encounter ourselves and know the stories that we tell ourselves. A hindrance is only a hindrance when we're caught by it, when it takes power over us. But when we look at it, name it, investigate it, it becomes an object of our meditation. Then it loses power over us. An important thing to always remember is that you want to notice the passing away of a hindrance. Oh, I'm not feeling doubt anymore. And you know, it happens, it's so subtle, you don't notice the moment. You have to pay very close attention to notice the moment when the hindrance moves away. Rejoice that all your hindrances are impermanent. Thank you. Questions? Comments? Throwing apples at the teacher? No. Yes.
When you were at the retreat in the guided meditation, how did you know that coming back and saying, oh, I just don't like guided meditation, that wasn't in and of itself a doubt? Like, hey, maybe you could like guided meditation and you were just, I mean, you know, so I'm thinking, I want to learn how to drive autocross, my latest passion, and I'm really doing poorly. Going very, very slow. I'm wondering, am I just slow? Am I ever going to be faster? Like, should I just accept that I'm slow? Like you say, I accept that I don't like guided meditation.
Well, I'm first of all going to say that I don't favor guided meditations, but I've also been engaged in guided meditations I found very beautiful and very helpful. So it's not a blanket statement. What I notice is that I have a resistance to guided meditation. And so it's important for me to recognize that resistance. And working with it, I don't allow it to get to the point where I get into doubt about the practice based on what is a resistance to a specific thing. So that's how I actually use it. I don't say that, I don't turn it into a belief that I don't like guided meditations. I have a resistance to them. And I know what the resistance is. So I've kind of looked at that. What is the point of resistance? I've actually done guided meditations for other people that have worked very well. But I know what happens to me when I do a guided meditation. I'm following the thought of the person, and then they stop, and then they start somewhere else, and I'm, wait a minute. So I have a disjunction. I know what happens when that occurs. And so I have to decide whether it's more skillful to work with that resistance or not to set up the conditions for the resistance. So that's the distinction I make. I don't know if it helps with motocross, but I suspect someday you're going to be just going along and suddenly you're going to say, wow, that was pretty fast. Because I think that's the way it works. We practice and we run into resistances, but the more we practice, we somehow get there. And sometimes it's not where we expect to get, but we get there. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but I've often set out with a particular goal, and along the way, conditions change. And what actually emerges when I'm not too fixed on my belief is something that's quite beautiful. So I wish you luck.
Is it really possible based on one is being in meditation and having this structure of self observations from inception to the appearance of from inception to disappearance of any hindrance or any self doubt? Does it have any relation to personal human faculties to be present so it could deal with any hindrances or any self-doubt in meditation?
Let me see if I understand your question. You're asking, is it possible for hindrances to be removed based on the faculties of the person who is doing the meditation?
Yes, when the all.
Are you asking if it's a skillful?
Yes, when
technique?
When one is being observed from inception to the disappearance of any hindrance or self doubt when it starts to appear. Does it have any relation to when one is being observing his own faculties to deal with his hindrances when they appear? Are there any factors to remove them? Well, because apparently when one is being present for his own faculties, all of human faculties to be present, then maybe hindrances could be easily disappear or dealt with.
What I can talk about is my own experience with hindrances. I would say when I first started meditating, I was more often tied up with the hindrances. It would take me much longer to deal with any specific hindrance because they weren't so familiar to me. I didn't know as much about how they manifested in my body or how I reacted to them. I didn't know as much about myself and they lasted a longer time, and they were more overwhelming for me. Now, I recognize them when they appear, and I'll say, oh, restlessness, restlessness. I'll name it, I'll notice it. I think I'm faster to recognize it. I have more skillful means for dealing with it. I'll use all of the methods. I'll sometimes use the antidote. If it's restlessness, for example, I will not continue sitting on the cushion. I'll do walking meditation, which takes care of some of that extra energy. Or if it's doubt, for example, I'll remind myself that I've experienced doubt before, that I don't know how real this doubt is, and I'll follow it through. So there's a certain amount of experience with dealing with the hindrances that makes a difference. There's an earlier recognition of the hindrance, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to pass away quickly, more quickly. So I recognize it more quickly. I have more means at my disposal for dealing with the hindrances. But still they come. And they take turns. And maybe for 2 years it's mostly restlessness. And maybe for 2 years it's mostly one of the others. Maybe it's desire this time. You know, they come and go. Everyone has to deal with hindrances.
And also there is this system that back in the East they practice that relates self-doubt and hindrances through lack of personal, the structure of personal management information system.
Mm-hmm.
When one is clear about what runs as far as the one's experience in the past, based on the infinite information that runs through any human being, when there is no structure for managing the flow of the information that could overcome the being, then there would be chaotic, there would be self-doubt, and so on and so forth. So is it possible that when one is lack of personal information management system, then automatically self-doubt or hindrances sets in?
I hesitate to say anything that is automatic. However, I think that anyone who engages in a meditation practice has to also deal with the psychological information that comes up. And some people have more experience with that than others. And some people have had more psychological help than others. Some very long-term meditators engage in some co-practices with their meditation, like the Diamond Heart work, where people do meditation and psychological work together. It's a very highly evolved system, and they feel that that helps both aspects of themselves, both their spiritual practice and their psychological makeup. All of these things, certainly psychological toughness, personal emotional maturity has a lot to do with what happens in your meditation practice. Is that what you're referring to? Does that address what you would like to know? Okay. So, thank you for your question. It's very difficult to just say that things pass, but what we want to do when we're doing the meditation is to not turn it into a psychology session, not turn it into a self-improvement session. When we're meditating and we're following our breath and we're being mindful of our breath, we're being mindful of the present moment. Now, things will arise that have to be dealt with. But part of dealing with the hindrances is to stick with the practice for this period, just for this period, and then work with the material that comes up at another time.
Actually, Germans,
they have this particular system that deals with self-doubt. They say when self-doubt arises, there are 3-4 steps and one could deal with them. And fundamentally what they say is that trust is good, control is better, but the best is to own oneself, in which when self-doubt, when they're designing variety of machineries or high-tech and so on, to control to own oneself. So when you own oneself, then there is no room for doubt to show up. And when they do, by observing the flow of the doubt and resistance, it creates incredible resistance to follow these hindrances and self-doubt. And when you own one, then you could follow it till it disappears. And by being self-clarity, you could easily make it not necessarily push the hindrances to go away, but to follow it till it disappears by itself, because it has nowhere to go except disappearance.
Yes, I would support that. I mean, the important thing is to be with whatever is happening. And if that's what's happening, you have to follow it and know it and not push it away, but be with it. And eventually it does pass away. Yes. Do you need a microphone back here?
It seems to me that if you're in doubt, you cannot be in the present moment because you are comparing yourself to some moment in the future. That's by definition what doubt is.
Doubt has many characteristics. It can be something about the past. It can be a sense of failure. It can be aversion to failure. It can be fear about what may or may not happen. It could be there's often fear associated with doubt. But what I'm recommending is that you recognize doubt, which is occurring in the current moment. Doubt is occurring in the permanent moment. To investigate doubt, you look at the story behind the doubt, and that's where you find things like fear of the future or comparing mind. And then you know the source. I don't want to use that. You're not following doubt to solve it. You're only recognizing its presence. And when you know that, looking at doubt, that the reason you're experiencing doubt has to do with your fear, when you look behind the doubt, fear of perhaps the future, then you know you're not in the current moment.
But I still think that, like, if you take your example of driving home,
mm-hmm.
if you don't think, oh, I'm 45 minutes from home, then you can't be in doubt. If you're only in doubt by comparing yourself to your goal.
I think it's important not to confuse the goal with the present moment, which I think you would agree with. I think you're actually saying that. So when I say recognize doubt in the present moment, then let's say I'm driving home, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to make it home. I'm not going to make it home. I can't go past this moment. Has nothing to do with whether I can or cannot. That's just the thought that's passing through my head. And that's in the current moment. The thought is in the current moment. It isn't that I don't know whether I'm going to make it home or not. I don't know the future, but I know that right now I have a fear about the future. That's what's happening now.
But again, isn't it a fear of that's a result of comparing your current position against the goal?
But see, I don't care what gave rise to it. I'm only looking at what it is. You see the difference? Okay.
He just said it's like comparing to the goal, but with doubt, it's often based upon the past. It's not necessarily based into the future. It's taking maybe an experience of the past and projecting it,
into
the future.
There are many causes of doubt. Sometimes it's disappointment against one's own expectations. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes it's weariness. I'm just tired, and I doubt. There are lots of reasons. There are lots of things that give rise to doubt. Doubt, the way we described it, remember, was a wavering, an indecisiveness. Self-doubt is only one form.
My other question was, could you just very briefly tell the antidotes to the other hindrances?
Oh, well, let's see. It's 9 o'clock, so I want to honor that. But let's see if we can give it a try. Desire, an antidote to desire that is often used is to think about things that are bad. Think about your impending death, for example. That usually sobers you up quite a bit. Think about every day I live is one day closer to my life. Actually, the anything that brings you back, gets you out of that clinging, will be an antidote to that. Okay, that's one. An antidote to ill will is loving kindness, metta meditation. Although the danger with that is that you are using it to push something away. And then it becomes an aversive reaction as opposed to an antidote. Sloth and torpor, what often you can do is bring energy into your practice so you can open your eyes or change to walking meditation, sit up a little straighter, those kinds of things. Restlessness, the antidote to that is to find a way to dissipate that energy. So, once again, changing from sitting meditation to walking meditation is one way of doing it. Sometimes just recognizing restlessness will do that for you, and you'll say, oh, I'm just going to relax. You consciously tell yourself to relax once you recognize it. Okay? So thank you all very much. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Drive carefully. And may all your hindrances be short-lived.